Hey, Buttheads, welcome back to Bob's Megas is Not a Butthead. I am Richard.
And I'm Kyle, and I'm here too. What's up, Richard? How's it going?
Oh, man, I'm over-caffeinated, but we get to talk about Death Becomes Her today, which is awesome. I know you've got a big history with it, which I want to hear about. I had never seen this movie before. This was one of the movies, one of the reasons why I wanted to do this podcast is to fill in the gaps that I had in the Zemeckis filmography. And this is obviously one of the big ones, and holy shit. I love this movie.
I've been excited just because, well, Richard, you're watching Death Becomes Her for the first time. You're a big Bob Zemeckis fan. So how did you enjoy Death Becomes Her?
Quite a bit. It surprised me constantly. Mm-hmm. I laughed a lot. Makes the fact that he EP'd the Frighteners make a whole lot more sense. They feel right hand in hand tonally almost. Same with like Beetlejuice. It's just released a few years after Beetlejuice, but such great energy, such big performances. The special effects are great. Just the story twists and turns, and oh my gosh, the planning of Meryl Streep's death in the middle of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, so good. Oh, and Sidney Pollack. Ah, there's so much good stuff to talk about.
Lots of good stuff. So, yeah, I know my reaction was, we used to watch it a lot. Just it was one of those movies that was on TV all the time when I was a kid. So I feel like I've always been aware of it on some level, but it's one of those films, like many movies, that I remember watching in pieces. And I think I watched the back half of it probably, a half dozen times before I ever watched the front half of it. And of course, at the time, as you're a kid, you take everything as a whole. And then now it's been interesting to get a few years of distance and look at it. My first reaction was just, it's like, of course I responded to this when I was a kid, because it's just a really long Tales from the Crypt episode, and I loved Tales from the Crypt. And then come to find out, as we were just doing a little bit of poking around prior to this podcast, that of course, and I remember vaguely being aware of this at some point in the past, that it was in fact going to be produced as a Tales from the Crypt movie. And it's funny, I ended up looking just on YouTube at some period behind the scenes stuff, like it just sort of popped up, and it was about the special effects. I actually clicked on it because it was about about CGI. It was like a special feature about CGI from like 1992. So it was really fun. They're like, what we're going to do is use computers to put these two images together, and it will seamlessly connect them through computer magic. It's like that was the level of the conversation about computers. Is that they were basically magic. So anyway, but the fun part about it was clicked on it, and literally underneath the, like, Zemeckis talking about the movie and Zemeckis talking about the special effects and everything is the Danny Elfman Tales from the Crypt theme playing. It's just fucking playing. Yeah. And it's a period special feature. So I guess probably at the time they were knocking that together, maybe, again, it's just something that was pulled over. They had the rights to use it, or maybe it's an artifact from a time when the two things were still connected. So,
well, Zemeckis was an executive producer on Tales from the Crypt, which we'll talk about in the Tales from the Crypt episode, because he directed three of those. That'll be next.
I know. We need to announce, Richard, that this is
Halloween month.
It's Halloween month. That's why. So we did what we've done Back to the Future. We've done Roger Rabbit. We're going to take a small hiatus from doing the movies in order. We're going to put off Back to the Future 2 and 3 for Turkey Month. Then what are we doing? What do we have coming up on Halloween month?
Oh, man. Well, Amazing Stories is live, which is a horror comedy episode. So if you haven't watched his Amazing Stories episode, jump on that. We're doing Death Becomes Her. We're going to do the Tales from all three of his Tales from the Crypt episodes in one go. And
then
the
Richard,
witches.
Yes,
and then
tell
the witches.
Why. Yes, exactly. Tell us why, Richard. This is an extra special October if you're a Zemeckis fan. Richard, and why is it a special October?
Yeah, Zemeckis is doing another adaptation of Roald Dahl's The Witches, which the original movie I know that you and I both love, and I will watch any time. But he's got Anne Hathaway playing the Angelica Houston Grand High Witch role, which looks like a lot of fun, and Octavia Spencer's in it. And it just, oh man, it looks... Mm. Watching Death Becomes Her, I was like, oh man, this witch's thing could be Oh, really fun. We're gonna do a quick reaction to that once that drops on HBO.
Yeah.
Max
so what's your reaction to the trailer then, Richard? Because my thing, I thought it was really funny. It's interesting that to have, because Witches was another one of those movies that I watched a ton when I was a kid. So at first glance, it's kind of interesting that how strongly it evokes The Devil Wears Prada, you know, mm-hmm. with literally, you know, Anne Hathaway basically dressed in the same kind of herringbone kind of stuff or whatever that Meryl Streep, again, it's all connected. It's all connected, Richard. So she's, of course, in Devil Wears Prada, and like it sort of evokes it subtly, but then Stanley Tucci's in the goddamn trailer, so it seems to very
rats.
Strongly, which is,
they
yeah, it's interesting.
Rats.
Spiritually, yeah. It makes sense. It makes no sense that Robert Zemeckis would be evoking Devil Wears Prada on paper, and yet it makes all the sense in the world, because it's so, I so liked seeing those two on screen again together.
I think, and watching the trailer, obviously, I had to watch it twice. The first time was just reacting to it with the original adaptation of The Witches in mind, and he's swinging in a different tonal space, mm-hmm. so I had to kind of absorb that. But once we get later into his filmography, mm-hmm. namely with the Walk and even Welcome to Marwen, which I'm really excited to watch and just see what the chatter is about that mm-hmm. one. But with those two films, he went in a completely different tonal direction than the docs, like mm-hmm. swinging wildly in the other direction, and it feels like he's kind of doing that a bit here, which mm-hmm. plays to his strengths in a lot of respects. So I'm not sure on the CG mice, but he's the effects guy, so you know what, I'm gonna hold judgment until I see it. I just miss those mouse puppets. I love those mouse puppets.
The mouse puppets are very charming. You know, it's kind of hard to outcharm a Jim Henson puppet. So,
But we'll get into that once that drops and we have a chance to watch it. And looking forward to it. And I'm sure there will be a lot to talk about with that one. But yeah. Back to Death Becomes Her. I did a mm-hmm. little bit of digging on how this kind of came together.
Wait
obviously.
A minute, real quick, Richard. Yeah. Does yeah. Witches come out on October 26th?
Yeah, or 22nd. I can't remember.
Does it 22nd? Okay, because I remember this stood out to me, of course, doing this Death Becomes Her episode in October, because there is a subtle reference to Back to the Future in Death Becomes Her, where she says, when Goldie Hawn is asked when she took the potion, she says October 26th, 1985. Now, of course, that's easy for me to remember because it's my brother's birthday. It's, you know, and I was born in September 26th, 1985, relatively close to that. So it stands out. But it's interesting. It's interesting to see that, to see, you know, Zemeckis, his films.
It's all the same world.
As we all know, Back to the Future was magically connected in all sorts of fun ways to The Walk, and now we see things circling back around. I want The Witches to come out on October 26th, which would be exactly, what is that, 35 years from yeah. October 26, 1985. An interesting date. And I turned 35 this year, Richard. What does it all mean? And I'm doing this podcast about Zemeckis. What's happening, Richard?
It's synchronicity, I think.
That's right.
Anyway, did a little bit of reading on this. I didn't know any of this, which was really cool to see. We know David Cope. How do you say his name? Cope?
Yeah, David Cope. Yeah. Yeah, David that was Kep. Surprising to me, too. I forgot that he was one of the writers on this, and you know,
this actually kind of launched him. He was doing indie stuff, and you'll appreciate this, Kyle. He was partnered with this Martin Donovan guy who he co-wrote the screenplay with. Mm-hmm. They were making indie films, and like they did one really, really low budget one together. He was able to get an agent out of it, and they decided they were going to write four scripts all set in different rooms of the same apartment building, and this ended up becoming one of those. They dropped the other three, and they were like, well, we're gonna make this, it's gonna be a super low budget movie, the max we would probably get is $5 million, mm-hmm. but they're looking like sub-$1 million for this thing. Zemeckis, who is EPing Tales from the Crypt at this time, mm-hmm. His agent reads it and was like, you gotta read this. So he does, which is why it almost was a Tales from the Crypt movie. But he signs on, and suddenly this indie script that they were going to produce for, you know, less than $1 million suddenly has Zemeckis, who's one of the biggest blockbuster directors at the time, and $40 to $50 million to throw at it, and getting Meryl Streep and Goldie Hawn and Bruce Willis. So, and then, like, through the end, this is how he gets Jurassic Park, which kind of launches him into the Spider-Mans and the Mission Impossibles and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skulls and the Tom Cruise Mummy movies. But this is the kind of one that opened a lot of doors for that name, which very... I didn't know that.
And Stir of Echoes. Didn't he direct Stir of Echoes?
Yeah. Right.
That was a big one. I remember watching a lot of things on TV when I was a kid.
And thinking about my reaction to the movie, there were so many moments in it where the story just turned in a way that I didn't expect. Like with the Goldie Hawn eating the cake icing and the fat suit. Like, I didn't expect that. That was crazy. All the time jumps were great, and the switching of kind of the sympathetic character.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, that was one of those fun things. It's a really interesting film to, because, you know, but like a bunch of movies, you tune into them on TV halfway through, you know, when I was a kid, you end up watching it. So I would generally tune in more when, you know, there were, you know, zombies trying to kill each other with shovels. Yeah. And I'm like, what's this? And I would keep watching it to the end. And so I pretty much assumed, I think, when I was a kid that I had seen the film all the way through. Yeah, it's that movie where it's all set in a big house and, you know, the redheaded lady and the blonde lady run around with shovels and try and kill each other. I know that movie. And then it was one of those things probably at some point, you know, in adolescence, I actually sat down to watch the film from the beginning for the first time, assuming, like, yeah, I'm pretty sure I know this whole thing. I've seen it a bunch of times. So I sat down to watch it through. And then I remember it was at that Goldie Hawn fat suit moment where it shows her. I'm like, I have not seen the beginning of this movie ever. And I like it a lot. So
that part is so wonderfully dark. It's so strange. Just spooning cake icing into her face while laughing maniacally at Meryl Streep being strangled while people barge into her apartment to kick her out. Oh, my gosh. That made me so, so happy. I want to make one more comment about the David Kep.
Kep. I think it's... I've heard David Kep before, but go ahead.
I've always pronounced it wrong. The one bit of trivia, you may have read this too, but the line in Jurassic Park, the famous line from Jurassic Park, when Samuel L. Jackson says, "Hold on to your butts," comes out of this movie, because when they were doing test screenings, they had to do some reshoots to fix the ending. And when they sat down, they didn't have time to fix it anymore. It was like the last... It was like it either worked or it didn't. And when they sat down before they played it, Zemeckis says, "All right, hold on to your butts." And that's where that line comes from, is them like trying to thread a needle to hit a release date and hoping what they reshot worked. But that tickled me so much that line, which we all know and love, is actually Zemeckis.
Zemeckis line. Absolutely. That's rad. I did not know that, but that's super fucking cool. So, Richard, what is this movie about, This Death Becomes Her, for the uninitiated? So what are we dealing with in this film? What did old David Kep and whoever the other guy was write down?
I think the best way that I saw it described in some of the reviews was Chuck Jones meets Sunset Boulevard.
That is a very good description, actually. It's very efficient.
Very efficient. You have Meryl Streep, who's an aging actress, who's trying to stay as young as possible. You have Goldie Hawn, who has her fiancé, Bruce Willis, ripped away from her by Meryl Streep. So she's in a jealous rage the entire movie, which leads into the fat suit and then... obviously some zombie revenge plots. And
we've passed up the fact that their names are Madeline and Helen, who then, when they first see each other, who are childhood friends, that's Mad and Hell are their names.
Right.
So there you go. That's obviously a reference to Paddy Chayefsky's Network script, "I'm Mad as Hell and I Can't Take It Anymore." Also a film critical of the entertainment industry. Are you staying with me, Richard?
I'm with you.
Okay,
yeah.
Perfect. I don't know if that's true. I mean, it sounded okay.
You said it so straight. I was like, yeah.
I mean, it might as well be, Richard.
It might as well be. And I think what shocked me was you talked about the holes in the chest and the shovel fight. I was surprised at how late in the film that comes. Like, I was expecting that energy, or not that it doesn't have that energy for the most part, but was really surprised and delighted, to steal the line from screenwriting class, that the movie is really fun and enjoyable and a lot of twists and turns. So when that happens, you're like cheering. It didn't take away from my enjoyment at all, like anticipating that moment. I was I was enjoying all the stuff in the lead up, which I think was wonderful. And I think part of that comes from Zemeckis was I heard him talk about it was one of the first things he read where he immediately envisioned cast with it. And he intentionally went and tried to cast against type with all these things, because Bruce Willis is obviously coming off of Die Hard and Die Hard 2 and Hudson Hawk being big action star. And in this, he plays a wiener. And then Meryl Streep, who's fresh up off Oscar noms in 79, 80, 82, 83, 84, 86, 88, 89, and 91.
It's amazing you committed all those to memory, Richard.
I'm reading it off of a paper.
No, I know you do.
this is her only big effects movie, which she said was more like going to the dentist, even though she's phenomenal in the movie.
Yeah. Word.
But yeah, it was just fun to watch Streep. She is so good.
I think that's part of it, is the thing, and it's sort of the same thing I was talking about a minute ago, where so much of the, I mean, literally the images on the front of, on the, you know, front cover of the film, Meryl Streep with her head turned around, hole through middle of Goldie Hawn, it seems like this is going to be, you know, very wild, and it is a very wild film throughout, conceptually and cinematically and otherwise, but yeah, a lot of the images that definitely stay with you don't really show up until that big final fight. But that being said, it is a wacky ass movie prior to that in all the best ways. And you have Zemeckis doing all of his fun, like subtle stuff in this. This film is full of all, he's playing with mirrors the whole time. Streep is introduced in the ring of that mirror when she goes to the freaky ass dentist, or plastic surgeon's office. You're catching in the mirror these weird blood procedures going on in other rooms and all of that kind of stuff. Yeah. And of course it's fun now to watch those early parts, which probably I, you know, was like, yeah, this is the story when I was a kid and I would get through. It's funny to look back now and just look at how playful and how funny and how crazy they are and how well he really does create, you know, because a majority of the scenes, they're funny. The characters are telling jokes. They are entertaining to watch. He's not using monologues to develop his themes. He's not using, or his motifs. He's not using anything. He's not using a bunch of characters sort of intoning, you know, about how, you know, oh, the vanity of LA is tearing me apart and I feel like I'm aging. And this, he builds in these motifs that he needs to draw from later, just with a lot of fun use of mirrors and how he is portraying LA with this insane, the guy with the twitching eye, implies the kind of brutality. I know, which just implies the brutality of plastic surgery and all of that. And I'm sure it's something that just sort of came along, but it's great. And he's a little mad scientist. He comes back later. I don't know. It's just, I find myself, honestly, when I was watching it this time, really enjoying all of the anticipation, and especially all the stuff with Meryl Streep and Isabella Rossellini, enjoying all of that, the front half of the film, more, you know, or just loving it throughout. And I don't know. I don't know. Go ahead, Richard. What was your take on all of this?
Yeah, you saying the mirror thing, I didn't even catch that. But you're right. Like, it does open with her staring into the camera through
a mirror. A fake mirror, a fictional mirror.
Right.
A mirror that exists on the other side of the mirror, this mirror. That's how mirror this mirror is.
Yeah, and I think to your point about how cleanly it sets everything up without having somebody say all of the themes that it's attacking. It starts with this big musical number about vanity, about looking in the mirrors and seeing herself, and then pulls back to audience members leaving and Bruce Willis being completely enamored in what is obviously a really terrible show, and you have Goldie Hawn's like nervous eyes sitting there, and all that's the themes of the movie are established through that that silly song and dance number, and you get all the character dynamics, and again the one shot that's just beautifully lays out like where the movie is going to go and what the reactions are going to be throughout these characters. So it's like seeing some of the craft stuff like that. I know we don't want to talk too much about craft, but that big opening pullback from that lands on Bruce Willis. Oh my gosh, so good.
It's wonderful. I mean, that's the fun. It's like at this point we've kind of talked it to death, but all the show offiness of Zemeckis's, you know, cinema, just all the beautiful again, I guess really in context very Tales from the Crypty, but just very Hitchcockian sequences about the murder and all of that. It's just we see some Zemeckis classics like telling stories through picture frames that were slowly sliding by. Like, I love the moment when he's Bruce Willis is touching up her leg with the spray paint, and just how all of the complexity and the horror and the just sort of just very the grittiness of that process is just communicated by like this yellow brick road of gore and paint and like buckets full of blood that it pans up to right until you see her gray leg being spray painted. So you're again. And you know, it's weird, you know, cause it's something I had never really observed until we started watching, all of his films in sequence, but it's such a fun and effective way, type of storytelling where he just sets up picture frames on Bob Hoskins' desk or all of Bruce Willis's pictures showing how he aged in the funeral scene at the end of the movie that we pan through. And it's just, it's fun. I dig it.
I think that's something that we haven't talked too much about. This is the first kind of, that I recall us actually going through is, he's kind of a master of exposition. Masterful. Like, you're never like staring at a character say something. It's all through inserts or production design or some weird joke that actually is setting everything up later. And it's done throughout in this film. The one thing I did want to ask you about is that I was reminded, I think it was Raising Cain, but a big dolly shot where Bruce Willis is walking through and he's like, oh, well, where it ends on a silly face. And it's the De Palma movie where it's tracking through a hospital and ends on the same gag, basically, where the sheet comes off the head and you see this really silly face.
Oh, yeah, that thing where it reveals the horror. Yeah. It goes around. Yeah. I remember that shot. Yeah. Cool. I'm trying to remember the shot from Raising Cain, but there's so many weird, crazy shots with wide-angle lenses in Raising Cain. It's harder for
it
me
may
to
not
remember
have been,
a specific
it
one.
It may not have been Raising Cain, but I was immediately... I remember you guys, when you showed it to me many years ago, that was the thing, is it lands on a silly face. And even before then, you have him saying, oh, well, he died in the pool, and he like you get the gloves slapped on Bruce Willis's shoulder, which he then puts on, and he's like, he's really bloated, and he throws away the gloves. An assistant shoves on the bigger latex gloves, and then it lands on the really silly face and ends with the joke of, I'll add some depth and character. No, you can't possibly do that. It has to feel like him.
Yeah, that's my favorite. That's one of my favorite gags, is the carefully placed person that's there to obscure the reveal that just so the camera can work its way around. It's the same gag in Raising Arizona when they do that big dolly shot right before they reveal Holly Hunter in the police car sobbing, saying, "Hi, I'm Baron." Like, they use his body to hide her, and they have the strategically placed guy they work around so that they just... maintains the immediacy of the surprise of that reveal of that goofy face. And I love, that's a great joke, by the way. We need to talk just about that joke. He walks in, the guy's telling him that he was, well, what was it? He was having sex with an 18 year old in a hot tub, and that he has a smile that's completely undignified. What's the word that's using as a smile is
like
undignified?
That. Yeah.
And so we're literally going to, and then that reveals not only a horrific image, but also his big grin because he went out. And again, that, again, as goofy as that is, that's obviously, it's a dumb punchline. But at the same time, let's get heady about it for a second, because why the fuck not? It's another example, just like all those fucking mirrors, of him setting up themes and motifs that he's going to draw from later. The idea that one can find happiness in death, that this guy has lived his life to the fullest, put the pedal to the metal, you know, died, and he is in this state of just his skin's gray and rigor mortis out and everything, but he is smiling. And that's another thing where, again, we find where Bruce Willis ends up, who is observing this, you know, who's at the center of that scene, where he ends up at the movie is that realization that, yes, oh, one can smile on the other side. And we see him finally smiling in that image that we dolly passed in his funeral, and he's dead. We see him smile to death.
But back to the exposition, like, we need that beat, like, that scene has to exist to establish that he's the Undertaker morgue guy, and that's what his job is now, as opposed to the plastic surgeon, which that
and
joke,
again, it's when, such an insane, but I love it. It's so good.
Yeah, it's perfect.
Think about all the freight that one gag carries of the dead guy. It's like, you're setting up all of these motifs and themes, fine, but at the same time, you have to kind of sell the reality of the idea that one of the world's best plastic surgeons, who's very rich, is being called in for special jobs to work on dead bodies as a mortician or whatever the thing is. And you buy it because that joke works so well that you're so distracted by how funny that whole story and the scenario is. You just buy the reality in the background that makes sense. So what is whatever it is. So the horror of him spray painting them later on anyway. So
I think even if you continue that spray paint line when they go to the party and he's asked like how does he get the dead bodies looking so good, where you establish the spray paint thing, it's him saying this absurd line just to her abject terror because he spray painted her aunt.
Yeah, and again, as horrific as that is and as silly as it is, it makes even more explicit what he does, you know? And it's something that Isabella Rossellini, playing this devil figure later on, who exists in a house of mirrors, wearing all this glass stuff.
True.
She's like the mirror lady. It's this great thing that she whispers in his ear later on when she's trying to get him to take the potion. She says, this is the old... It's like, you know, you've already been doing it. You've been doing it your whole life. This is what you've been doing. It's the natural extension.
It's what you've been doing. It's what you've been doing for other people. It's time for you to be young forever.
Yes, and that's the thing. And it's one... It would be enough to have him be a plastic surgeon. Because plastic surgeons loaded with a lot of like, they're only after money and superficial things. But then to take it to concretize that idea that his life is in service of death, basically. Mm-hmm. Or in fear of death. They concretize that one step further. And he's not just a plastic surgeon. He's a plastic surgeon who works on dead people,
Too.
Yeah, and then not only that, now his movie star wife is going to be dead. He's going to be literally married to death and all that kind of stuff. So
well, it's what takes it... And I kind of made the note on this and thinking back on his other stuff, trying to, is this a farce or a satire? It's kind of writing a line between the two of them. Mm-hmm. And like that, him being the guy that works on dead people just kind of pushes it over the edge. So it has this more, this much broader, more absurd sheen to it. So you can still talk about those themes of like Hollywood being super vain and trying to stay forever young, but with instead of doing it with live people, you're doing it with dead people, which buys you the zombie and the holes in the chest and the shovel fights and the awesome, like dislocated neck. The dislocated neck.
It's called broken neck.
And you talked about the body obscuring for the joke later, which it plays again with the Sidney Pollack as the doctor in the hospital just later as a gag, slightly tweaked, where we're laughing at the horror of Bruce Willis realizing that that's where all the doctors are taking care of the doctor who had a heart attack because of seeing Meryl Streep dead. But yeah, it's right there.
Yeah. So what's fun is like why? Okay, so why? So the film is obviously, you know, it seems like a softball kind of critique. It's about Hollywood, and of course Hollywood is very superficial, and she's a big-time actress, played by a big-time actress, you know, she's married to a plastic surgeon, and it's all about being attached to, you know, the material world and all of these superficial things and wanting to cling to life and not move on and all of this kind of stuff. And so I think it's fun to have, like... to set up all these ideas of like Meryl Streep, she's always obviously, you know, mirrors are a pretty, you know, pretty unambiguous symbol. But then to take it a step further and have when she goes into Isabella Rossellini's house, what wreathes the door, these giant mirrors, the very same mirrors as she goes through this threshold of mirrors where she actually literally watches herself become, you know, youthful again. And it's an interesting movie because of one of the reasons that I just dig it is this relationship between Goldie Hawn and Meryl Streep, which is a strange one because they're both awful and they both become quite, you know, as Goldie Hawn, I think, said about it, like she starts out kind of ugly on the outside and inside, and then briefly they end up back in the same place again. And then you realize that kind of the character that, even though we kind of enter into it with Meryl Streep, the character who's really, who has to make the big choices in the end, who's the character of our identification in the film, is Bruce Willis. He's the guy who has to wrestle with that choice to live forever or not to live forever. And everyone else in the movie is sort of just these demons representing how alcoholism and a bad marriage has sort of made his life a hell, but a hell he's addicted to in this kind of cool way. So,
well, I was just thinking about it, I think this would, I'd be interested to do this as a double feature, like as a palate cleanser to Seven, because just looking at it, you have the seven deadly sins like peppered through lust, Bruce Willis wanting Goldie Hawn when she's trying to seduce him in the thing.
Yeah,
lust,
fun.
He wants Meryl Streep. He ruins his life to get Meryl Streep. Envy, obviously Goldie Hawn's character, because the Bruce Willis has taken away. Sloth, you have her eating the ice. Sloth and gluttony, you have her sitting in the chair in eating the cake icing. Pride is Meryl Streep's downfall, not wanting to be cheap. Greed, also Meryl Streep. And then wrath is Goldie Hawn trying to murder her. So it's all there, just peppered throughout. It's not like it's shoving a pie in your face, but it's all peppered throughout very, very cleanly.
And then when you finally arrive at seven and you have the seventh sin and there's nowhere else to go, where do you go? Shovel fight. Zombie shovel fight. That's where you have and just total bonkers Looney Tunes-ness. That's where you go at the end of that.
Somebody needs to have a talk with David Fincher.
Yes. See? There you go. I know. It's like the end, it was good, you know, the end of seven, but it could have done with a shovel fight. Think about it. Kevin Spacey versus Brad Pitt.
The shovel fight, I just want to say one thing. That Meryl Streep is so good in this movie. The line in the middle of the shovel fight, and she's screaming at her, and she says, "I can see straight through you." The way she delivers that line with her head through the hole, I died. Same with the other line I want to call attention to, because we kind of burned past the first part, is in the when she first meets Bruce Willis and she's like, "I'm so happy for you both." The way both is just tacked on the end. Oh, it's so wonderful to watch that. And I think just thinking about how good they all are in this movie, we think of Zemeckis with all of these special effects, which he's obviously very, very, very good with. But he's so good. He's so good with actors. Like, they're all so great.
And that's the thing, is it was really interesting to see, like, Goldie Hawn fits right in with, you know, as we kind of talk about the Zemeckis styles, all of these high energy, just performances at 10, performances at 11, these Chuck Jones level performances. And you have Meryl Streep, who rises right up there. The one area that, to me, felt now watching it, where the one person who maybe wasn't bringing it to the level of everyone else, though he's still quite good in it, but I'll explain why, is Bruce Willis.
I agree.
Because, because it's the kind of thing where, I heard at one point that it was, that maybe they tried to cast Kevin Kline. A Fish Called Wanda era, or a little bit after that, Kevin Kline. He's like exactly the actor you want in a Robert Zemeckis movie, who is going to bring the physicality and the cartooniness. Because, and here's the thing, Bruce Willis is very, very good, because it's not about good acting or bad acting. It's an issue of, like, he grounds the movie. He seems kind of tragic and sympathetic the whole time, and in a way it has this interesting effect. And I wonder, to the extent that this might have globally affected the experience of watching the movie, it has this effect of making the film feel slightly more tragic because he's in it. Like, if there were a comedian or someone who was being a little bit more arch in that role, then it would feel like he occupied that, like, kind of the same world as these, you know, zombies who are fighting each other with shovels. But he kind of has this earnestness to him. Literally, the character's name is
Ernest. His name is Ernest. I wrote that down.
Which is funny. Importance of Being Earnest, written by Oscar Wilde, who wrote Portrait of Dorian Gray. Not aging. Fun stuff. Maybe,
I like I how know. Far around you went with that. Jesus, well, that was really good, Kyle.
Yeah, but when you think about, like, people, well, I mean, Oscar Wilde, you know, evoking Oscar Wilde is not that hard. It makes sense in this movie, but who knows?
Right.
Anyway, but he has the kind of earnestness. Like, let me explain. Like, it's like Inherent Vice. You know how we heard that originally that it was, like, going to be Robert Downey Jr. in that movie, and you could get it because it was going to be, like, or there was a rumor, whatever it was, and you could see it because it would be, like, the long goodbye, and he would have this 70s Elliot Gould. I mean, it's basically kind of what Robert Downey Jr. is doing anyway. It's kind of Elliot Gould from, like, so many good Elliot Gould movies.
The Long Goodbye.
If you haven't seen Busting, directed by Peter Yates, direct that one, or watch that one. Robert Blake is in it, but don't let that stop you. But anyway, and then Joaquin Phoenix is cast in that movie, and Joaquin Phoenix is a really good actor.
He's very good.
That's a controversial statement. But within the context of that movie, Joaquin Phoenix feels so very, very grounded that all of the insanity of the rest of Heron Vice, which you might accept if Robert Downey Jr. as this sort of like fairy who's floating above everything else is sort of floating through, you kind of want the world to make a little bit more sense. And so it kind of, there's this weird friction that's interesting in that film that makes me want to wish that I could see that Robert Downey Jr. version of that. And it's the same kind of thing when I'm looking at Death Becomes Her now, where I'm looking at it and I'm like, man, Bruce Willis is really good, but at the same time, he's drawing my empathy in and making me less enjoying the Chuck Jones of it all and more making me feel that he is the put-upon victim at the center of all of these monsters. And I don't know if, again, that was just my reaction going through this time, but then you wonder, and I can't help but speculate, and again, Bruce Willis, great actor, but I can't help but remove him in my mind and stick Kevin Kline in there giving a gymnastic performance like he gave in A Fish Called Wanda, and just feeling like he could go toe to toe with Meryl Streep and go toe to toe with that Zemeckis level of performance, and you know, kind of play the more of a goofy shit heel at the middle of these things, who kind of emerges as a surprise empathetic hero at the end, whatever. I mean, hero to the extent that he doesn't take the potion, you know. So
I would agree with that, but there are so
many. But Bruce
Willis
is still great in the movie.
Still,
I mean, he's so good,
his,
though.
The she's gonna be, she's in the morgue. She's gonna be furious, and his it's a miracle, and his what if I get bored? That's my favorite line in the movie. It's like, what if I get bored? Is his first response to Living Forever?
Yes.
It just so good.
Yeah. No, I love him throughout, and he fits well, and he gets it. Like Bruce Willis, you see him being charming and witty and cool and funny in other movies, but you do see him pushing, like, and I love the sequence where he's put, like, with the fictional sequence where he's putting the poison in the glasses and all the other things, and given those, that would have been my pick for Richard's favorite moment, is when he's putting the poison, and you have that huge wide-angle pushing down the table.
I love that sequence.
I feel like
I
that's
that
nine
sequence.
Different commercials and videos you've directed, isn't
yes.
exactly that shot, or you sitting there in front of a big wide-angle camera, Richard. I know, and I thought of you, Richard, and I thought Richard loves this shot.
I saw that shot, and I was like, hell yes. And just his face while he's doing it, with twisting the glass and doing this dumb, like, concentrating thing.
Yeah.
Like, and that sequence is so good, dude. It's so good. And I love just the end of that sequence where she's in the crematorium. They lift up her arm and it has the vodka bottle fused to her arm. Yeah. And the coroner looks at it and reads her blood alcohol level. It's just so tight and perfect. And Goldie Hawn is delivering the plan in the fantasy moments. It's just this wonderful. And the car explodes immediately in impact. And the amount of booze they put in that car.
Finally, you see when you move into when you finally cross to the other side of the mirror and you get to the literal dream world, and it becomes Zemeckis sort of unleashed. And you see that's the way he would be making movies if he could. Skeleton hands being raised into frame, shotgun holes being blown through the middle of people, and I dig it.
Let's talk about that shotgun hole.
Because
holy god, like there's two moments that really get me with that, and one is when Meryl Streep throws the stick through her, because that's just cool in and of itself. And I kind of get how they did that. And I love Meryl Streep's performance in that, by the way, where she's like, yes, ooh, no. so great. But when Goldie Hawn sits down onto it and it comes out of her, I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't know how that happened. Like, I really don't. I know how it happens now, today, in 2020. Yeah. But I don't know how that happens in 1992. That blew my mind.
Well, what's fun about that, and what it reminded me of, was the fact that, you know, some of the it was a time when you know, CGI and when these new computer effects were one of many tools being applied to sort of pull off a magic trick, something that would legitimately delight audiences. You see the same thing, and you see it applied in subtler forms even when you get to Forrest Gump, which we'll get to when we get to Forrest Gump, when he uses CGI to create a fake table next to Lieutenant Dan when he's on the ground. So when he turns his like stump legs past the table, you know, it really sells the idea that his legs aren't actually there, you know. And I love that. I love mixing, like, the fact that she sat down and they probably shot a stick and they composited this thing together, whatever. And it legitimately has the effect of being like a magic trick where you're just like, hey, and it's delightful. It's and then, unfortunately, I think that you just see less and less of those clever kind of gags now that mix those things together. Some people still do it and do it really, really well. But you see less and less of a mixture. Instead, you would see the hole would be CGI, the stick would be CGI, the couch would be CGI, her chest would be CGI. She would just be wearing a sock basically over her body.
Face, and, her face would be replaced in post.
Yeah. And there would be no element within it. And as a result, every aspect from the hole to the stick to the couch to, and its motion through the air and every aspect of it would feel fake and without weight or anything. And so, you know, it's like we would be aware of what was happening narratively, but it wouldn't, you know, surprise or delight us and make us grab our chest and say, holy shit, there's a stick going through the middle of Goldie Hawn. You know, it wouldn't sell. It doesn't sell that kind of reality. And it's so cool to look at this transitional point between practical effects and CGI, where you see so many cool things being created by combining them. Like, we'll have a CGI Tyrannosaurus Rex, sure, but then we'll also build a giant robot Tyrannosaurus Rex.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's rad.
I mean, and I think that we've just gotten away from that a little bit, where the CGI is CGI to because you can fix it in post, as opposed to it being a magic
today,
trick.
These kids, they're not building giant robot T-Rexes anymore. These kids, they lost the appreciation for. I don't know why they don't. I don't know why more student films don't feature giant robotic T-Rexes. I don't know what's holding them back from building those, but either way,
there's one other moment that I want to talk through, and that's Meryl Streep falling down the stairs.
Mm-hmm.
You may have seen the special feature on this too, but it's a different style there than he is used to. Normally, you see in all of his in most of his setups, he's come out and said in the special, in the interviews for this movie, that he tries to design shots that wouldn't have to be edited if they don't have to be. He's trying to not impose editing onto any scene, which makes total sense given how all of his films, especially through Back to the Future, through Death Becomes Her, you can see that, like, peppered everywhere. But that moment, he's like playing with editing, and he said the one thing he wanted to do with that scene, the one image that struck him in the script, was the script said she hits every step on the way down. And if you look at that, he's playing with time in a big way, and that's one of the few examples that or the only example I can think of offhand of Zemeckis using editing to make the joke rather than having the joke play in the master. But man, that works really, 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 really well.
Well, plus it makes sense. It's a wonderful thing to, it's like, how do you imply stairs? Just that staccato nature of stairs, you know, and hitting them and all of that. A bunch of fucking cuts and brutal cuts. Exactly. No, that is really fun. And that sequence with her just sort of rising up in the background. Mm-hmm. So that was interesting. That's fun. Is I think it was actually Meryl Streep's body walking backwards with a hood over her head. Because I came across a snippet of her saying that her mom visited the set the day she had the blue hood over her head. Which was, you know, a little in all of her little promotional interviews, that little anecdote.
It's a great physical performance.
It's a great, no, exactly. And that's sort of the thing, is it's great to see Meryl Streep acting as Meryl Streep and basically being a Babadook or whatever, which is basically what it looks like. She has the hood over her head and she's twisting her body around. And now they pay Doug Jones to do that in a bunch of movies every year. But it's cool that it's actually her there with a fucking blue hood over her head doing the thing. And but man, it's funny to hear her complain about feeling like, you know, it was all about the special effects. Things are going to go much more in that direction. Pretty soon the whole set was going to be a blue hood, Meryl.
Yeah,
it was going that way.
Yeah, man. And I think that's another thing. They won the visual effects Oscar for this film, deservedly so. And the ILM, they pushed the that's the first CGI skin that they used to blend the shot of her head and the shot of her body. And you get that crazy one when Goldie Hawn like smashes her on the head with a shovel, and you get that wonderful shot, the wonderful
that
Chuck Jones shot.
Yeah,
you get the wonderful Chuck Jones shots where her head has receded into her shoulders and it's just her eyes above her collarbone, and then she lifts her head up. Oh my gosh. It's so wonderful to see that. That's Meryl Streep.
Yes, I know. It's the silliest, most cartoony thing maybe in his whole career, and that's saying something. Her head springing up and down, and who does he do this with? Meryl Streep.
Meryl fucking Streep.
Meryl fucking Streep. So,
What else did you want to talk about on this, Kyle? I know there's so much we haven't hit. Going through my notes here.
I know it's interesting looking at it now and kind of seeing Bruce Willis's character's choice at the end and sort of a little bit more of what I appreciate now. And it, even though this wasn't your classic Zemeckis and Gale screenplay, it still has many of those hallmarks. Mm-hmm. You can see why he responded to it in that. Again, what I like is that it's a film that constantly exists in jokes and exists in funny gags, but is still cultivating fun themes and ideas that are informing the character's choices, and then ultimately paying off in really fun ways at the end. Like, I love the funeral scene at the end, you know, obviously starting life at 50 and everything. It's not exactly subtle.
And he becomes super potent.
yes, that's right. And he's just so fertile with all of this. Yeah, and again, we've literally made it. We've talked about, his other films. We've talked about how in Back to the Future, there's that sense of this, like, humiliation of the father in this mm-hmm. sort of fallen world, in this sort of post-Vietnam world, and looking back to something before that potentially something was lost that has caused us to be on this dark path, and it literally has, like, God's energy striking a goddamn clock tower in the movie, a bolt from heaven. And this film, what does it end with? It ends with literally a goddamn preacher preaching to the audience, or preaching to the crazy zombie LA weird actress zombie face folks, just who have become grotesque monsters at this point, about how one lives forever is through connection with other people. And again, that's sort of something that it's not really even just specifically Christian, but even if you go through all Eastern traditions and magical traditions and all of that, that idea that, you know, we have fallen into this world and we will eventually return and connect to something else on the other side of it. And while we're here, we're just supposed to connect to other people and live on forever through other people's memories of us and through the great things and the great relationships that we have had, yada, yada, yada. And instead, what do we have as the total antithesis of this? We have two characters who have nothing left but each other, which is why they represent interesting. Yeah, nothing left but each other. There's no connection. No one will remember them. Everything about them is a secret. And ultimately, they will be the only witnesses to them just continuing to exist now, trapped in the material world.
Together.
Trapped together and trapped in the material world, never transitioning over to it, never smiling like the guy is smiling when he died. The other thing I dug in the funeral scene, by the way, was his the charitable organizations he was marriage counseling. The Institute for Studying Women. That's great. It's like he knew that someone had to do that work.
Well, so. I think it's, you mentioned the fact that they're stuck together forever, and that was one of the things that watching it I was so tickled by is they're enemies this entire movie, and they're fighting with shovels and beating each other when they can't die, and they finally get into the root cause of their relationship, and it resolves so quickly. All they have to do is talk about their issues
for 1 second
and then they're suddenly on the same team. That is so pleasing to me as an audience member, to see them team up and try to go convince Bruce Willis that he has to stick around to make them pretty again.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my gosh, that was so wonderful.
It is delightful because you get into the film with kind of a bunch of it's hard to know where your empathies lie. And the moment they align with each other and they've become these sort of grotesque demons, and you see that written in that shot that follows when they make up after their shovel fight and they go and they see Bruce Willis, and then they see their long shadows creep up the wall behind him like goddamn Nosferatu, with the, of course, hole in the middle of Goldie Hawn's stomach. And they explain that they're friends now and all of this, and that he needs to fix them and all of that. And in that moment, that little alignment, which is satisfying and fun for those two characters, also puts all of our empathy, they've become monsters. They're literally, he had a couple options, you know, he was if it wasn't Meryl Streep, maybe it would be this other woman, you know, this other hot redheaded lady who was going to take him in. And now you realize that by his choices have closed him into a world of death where he has nothing but ghosts and corpses and all of that. So fun.
And then, of course, they try to drug him and poison him. Oh,
oh yeah.
So great. So great. And I love the just the smallest thing. And this goes back to, this could have been in the script. It may not have been in the script. But the whole, like, chart through of the dartboard is so, so wonderful. Like, that's the one, you see him drunkenly try to throw a scalpel at it at mm-hmm. the beginning, but he can't because he's too drunk and his hands are shaking. And that's the thing he packs up. It's like the one thing he has in that house. Like, that goes into the suitcase, and that buys you the, he's sober now, he's sworn off alcohol, and he throws the thing that hits the switch that makes the lights go out so he can escape. Like, that one little just small detail train feels so Zemeckis. Where
that's
it's
his
all,
skateboard.
It's all set up with a joke. It's his hoverboard.
Oh, yeah. Yes, it's hoverboard, exactly.
The you mentioned the earnestness, and I had written that down, and I think that's super important to keep in mind, considering his next film is Forrest Gump, which is kind of the epitome of cinematic earnestness.
That is a huge U-turn. At the same time, it feels like a huge U-turn in how those films are regarded, but at the same time, it doesn't at all. Kind of, it feels like a natural extension of a lot of the weird shit he's been exploring in the last several films. So.
Right, and I actually watched Back to the Future 3 in prior to this, just to make sure that I kind of understood where he was, and I was shocked to see Back to the Future and be like, wow, this is actually him taking some pretty gargantuan steps forward, just with the romantic relationship between Christopher Lloyd and the female lead, Mary Steenburgen. Where that's like the most romantic thing he had done to date, and really sits in those moments, and it is very earnest, hard on the sleeve, which kind of to me was like big telegraphing what he's going to do in Forrest Gump. Even in a movie like this, where he's playing in the Tales from the Crypt mode, you still have that earnestness, which I think is just looking forward to the walk and looking forward to even Welcome to Marwen, which I assume is going to be so earnest.
So what you're saying is that this is when he started to sell out. That's what you're saying. This is when Bob Z started to sell out. That's what you're saying.
You talk about the moral.
No,
I think you talk about the moral universe of him all the time, and I think that's just a critical part of it. Is like he's not trying to hide any of these things. They're very much all the themes and all the things he's trying to say. Even if there's some depth hidden, like there's a lot that he's putting on the surface that's saying like this is what this movie's about.
Yeah. No, a lot of his previous films kind of exist in that adolescent male Wild West. I'm out on the plains. I'm John Wayne riding a horse and shooting stuff energy. And then he's slowly starting to come back in. He's slowly starting to come home. Maybe he's having kids. I don't know. I don't care
for
the biographical details. But you should look into that, Richard.
I'll look into it,
Mr. Research. the other thing to talk about is Isabella Rossellini and how that factors into this film as a critique of Hollywood in a fun way. Because it's cool to see Isabella Rossellini, who's fucking rad in this movie. She is surprisingly good, especially at the end. It made me wish...
Siempre viva!
Exactly. You know, I mean, it's like, we know that she can play tragic big, you know, because of Blue Velvet. We know that she has it in her to go big. But what I dug about this was she's, you know, foreign and seductive and mysterious when we first see her. But at the end, when she's encouraging Bruce Willis and she creeps away from the camera with her fingers forward and that huge, that cobra snake-like
fan weird
behind her neck.
Yeah.
And she creeps back and she's... and she's siempre viva, and she has, of course, the big stained glass touching God thing above her. She was fucking great in this.
Yeah.
What I dug, though, of course, is the idea that, honestly, when she was being a little bit more out there, she started reminding me of Ingrid Bergman more. You know, it's weird. It's like she always... It's kind of hard to see the relationship between her sometimes. I mean, she does look like her, but it's kind of hard to see to kind of see it evoked. And yet, when she was creeping back and she and was playing things a little bit more arch and was a little bit more, I don't know, it was a little bit more... it was a cinematic style that obviously, because so much of this film... I mean, literally, there's a moment where the character says, as my previous client said, I just want to be alone. So she's obviously... That's Greta Garbo in... Night of the... What is the thing where she's the dancer or whatever?
I don't know.
Yeah,
but
okay,
you're talking old Hollywood. You're talking old Hollywood, and
Oh yeah, no, 100%. Yeah. I mean, yeah. And obviously, then that's a setup subtly for the good, the grand ball scene at the end where we see Marilyn Monroe. And it's weird though, because we see Andy Warhol, we see Marilyn Monroe, we see Elvis, which I dig, and those are obviously big gags. But I was really kind of searching and looking. I was expecting like Zemeckis to go more ham at the with that, and at the end
he went subtle with
it. Yeah, it was weird. It's not subtle in that. Obviously, it's Andy Warhol. Obviously, it's Marilyn Monroe. But it's like you kind of, some part of me expected it would be interesting to see why, because it seems like a deliberate choice to fill it with like more anonymous people in tuxedos peppered with a few people who stand out. And like even in wide crowd shots, you can see Marilyn Monroe and a few other people kind of popping out. But I
think it's
expecting...
a surprise. Yeah, I think it's a surprise because you start with Warhol and Marilyn Monroe and then go to Elvis, and you expect that as he continues, the gags are going to get bigger, but they get subtler because there's like... the last one is James Dean, which is super subtle. Definitely there. And and one of them had me guessing when Bruce Willis falls through the Adam and God touching fingers, which is a great symbolism as he forgoes eternal life and gets his life back, essentially. I think, is that supposed to be Jim Morrison, or is that just supposed to be a regular guy? Like,
wasn't that the guy who, I think that's the guy who plays Jim Morrison in Wayne's World 2, isn't it?
That's what I was thinking. I was like, is this supposed to be Jim Morrison? But he's not doing enough Jim Morrison-y things. So it's just
I saw him. I'm somewhere in there. Maybe we're talking about it, but I think I saw that guy in there somewhere.
The guy at the pool. He's in the pool with a girl. And
but what I like about the idea that her previous client was Greta Garbo. Greta Garbo's famous line, Greta Garbo retires. That's her famous on-screen line, but she was also very reclusive in the latter days of her life, yada, yada, yada. In fact, I think I even remember seeing an SNL skit when, like, God, who was it? I don't remember. It was in the 90s where they just keep repeating where they play Greta Garbo, you know, like in a hotel room by herself. God, who was it? Maybe Jan Hooks or someone played Greta Garbo wearing sunglasses and her hair up. And she's like, I just want to be alone. Like, bring me an olive, but a single olive on a plate. I want the olive to be alone. And so, you know, and so, but it's interesting is that idea that corruption, that deal with the devil, you know, with this literal like female snake figure, is not a new thing that has arrived on the scene in Hollywood, but has always been there.
Right.
And so then you wonder, and so again, LA is like is a potent symbol in any movie because it's a movie. And so like this whole the act of making the movie itself is then sort of drawn into it because again, which is delightfully Zemeckis in the same way that he literally, the car crashes into a fucking movie theater that we see Ronald Reagan's movie playing at in the 50s, and we see his whatever, a porno theater in Back to the Future, you know, is that evocation of cinema as being symbolic of our imagination, as being, you know, symbolic of what's on the other side of the mirror, as being symbolic of our subconscious, as being symbolic of basically the membrane that separates the spiritual world or the world of dreams and spirits and all of that from the material world. And it's so interesting to see that what he does is he puts all of Hollywood in this context where it's all as if it's all born from some deal with the devil, some grand conjuring whereby, and that, by the way, is not that inaccurate. If you look, there was a lot of weird, creepy, freaky occultism and stuff in the early days of Hollywood. Like, we were looking at the Boris Karloff mummy, or Cliff and I were looking at it the other day, and what is it, her name? I forgot her name. Crazy name. The female lead in the original, like, 1935 mummy movie with Boris Karloff. Like, she was literally had a class at the time she was teaching about how to combine acting techniques with Kabbalistic magic rituals and all sorts of things. And this is in the 30s. This is the era of your Greta Garbo. This is the era of, or a little bit thereafter, of Isabella Rossellini's mom, you know? And so it's this interesting implication that's there, this interesting implication just by casting her and putting her in here that's below the surface, but it basically says Hollywood by its very nature, which is, again, delightfully subversive thing for Zemeckis to say, who is engaged in the act of making a movie, is born of a deal with the devil, you know, is that it is born, like, of course it is, because when you think about all these bad people who are suddenly, I mean, this being the kind of hokey critique of Hollywood, terrible people who suddenly are rocketed to insane levels of fame and power, and how these ups and downs feel arbitrary as if they're being, like, decided by the whims of gods or angels. it's this really, it's a really, it kind of creeps you out on the whole idea of Hollywood and old Hollywood in a way that, in kind of the same way that like a movie like Sunset Boulevard mm-hmm. did before it, and a movie like Mulholland Drive, which strongly evokes Sunset Boulevard also in a lot of ways, does after it. It kind of takes the entire idea, even the nice ideas about Hollywood, the idea of wanting to make it and get rich and be a star, and it paints it as being just explicitly Faustian in nature.
Right.
So,
I mean... Yeah, I didn't know that about old Hollywood.
I know.
It doesn't really surprise me, but, like, yeah.
I'll tell you what. Now it's bothering Zelda. What is her name? I'll figure it out. You talk, Richard.
There's two other things that I... Just looking at his filmography and where this fits in it, and I think this is a good time to bring it up. I had written down this... Zemeckis is basically making the cinema of sexual frustration.
Zita Johan, look it up, everyone. She, after she retired from acting, she was a theater actress or whatever. She taught people how to practice literally merging their acting with magical practices, and that's not really relevant to this movie at all. But I still dig
it. It's an interesting note.
Yes,
but I wrote down this a couple movies ago, and this kind of just kind of solidified it in my head as something to look for in the movies coming forward. Is he's kind of making a cinema of sexual frustration. If you look at I Want to Hold Your Hand is all about sexual awakening, and Back mm-hmm. to the Future is about his mom coming on to him and being sexually frustrated, and mm-hmm. Christopher Lloyd not knowing what to do with Mary Steenburgen in Back to the Future 3.
It is an entire cinema of hiding your boner behind your textbooks.
Which is all Forrest Gump.
Yes.
Which is this with Goldie Hawn's like sex. Mm-hmm. Sexy. Sexual. Which
with
is a great moment.
Dress, yes,
But I think as something to look for, and his Amazing Stories episode, another reminder to go watch that. That is all about the boy being wanting to get with the girl and not knowing how.
Yes.
But just kind of that seems to be a through line. And the other thing that I think is hopefully worth talking about with Rachel, who I hope we have on for The Witches, is Zemeckis is really good at giving big female lead performances. Like, they're just everywhere. Contact, Mary Steenburgen, Leah Thompson gets a great role in Back to the Future. I Want to Hold Your Hand, obviously.
Coming off of this film, my first thought was Jodie Foster in Contact.
Jodie Foster in Contact.
I'm joking, because those are not similar at all.
They're not similar at all, but it's the big female lead performance. In terms of just... thinking about representation a little bit, he seems to be pretty progressive on that front. Another thing that
word
is worth seeing. But those are most of my notes.
Nice. No, I mean, dude, I don't know what I have. It was really interesting because of how many times I did probably just catch this on cable when I was a kid, to see how many subtle things had kind of worked their way. Like, again, this interesting association between kind of Hollywood and Greta Garbo and this, which I, it's just, it's strange because I, it's one of those things where you start like even in my own writing I've realized that I've like subtly ripped off so many little gags from like I feel like the it hit me. I'll tell you, I'm just sort of building, I'm trying to figure out the right context, but it was basically leading up to that cocktail party he walks into at the end where he runs into Meryl Streep, or when he runs into Marilyn Monroe and Andy Warhol and all of that. I just feel like on some level I have written some version of that beat about 10 different times over and over and over again, which it's not so, and it makes perfect sense because it's for the same reason I like a movie like Cabin in the Woods, which there's a subtle implication that this concept could be maximized and one could see like hundreds of monsters at the end of this movie. And there's a subtle implication about Hollywood at the beginning that it's all from its inception been sort of born of the devil. And I love that cocktail party at the end because it appeals on this grand scale to that silly, boyish nature of myself that wants to see the version where, well, like, shouldn't Marilyn Monroe show up? And then shouldn't a bunch of old movie stars? And I think that that anticipation is why I want to see, like, as I was searching through, and someone's going to point out right. to me later on, there's like 50 people that I didn't notice or whatever it was, because I've only watched it once. But I don't know. I dig that. And I just dig this. I just that whole scene, it's kind of an interesting. Obviously, in another way, it kind of evokes The Shining at the end, just by virtue yep. of the fact that it's a big cocktail party.
You were always here.
Exactly. And that's yeah. sort of where I was working to, is that whole notion of you were always here, but subtly implied through just a frame, showing that big frame at the end, everyone's in tuxedos. Right. I think we've answered our own question, Richard. That's why not so many people in costume as Marilyn Monroe or Andy Warhol. Because he needed the big wide shot of everyone in tuxedos to evoke The Shining, because that evokes the line, you have always been here. And that's what he was trying to say about Hollywood the whole time. That this thing, this Faustian deal, it was there the whole time, Richard. He's mad as hell and he's not going to take it anymore.
Madder in hell. That's, you say mad in hell. His name is Earn, so it's Madder in hell.
Madder in hell.
Madder in hell.
Ah, that's fun.
Fun, silly stuff. Just right on the nose, cake
Madder
in the face.
Madder in hell.
It's, yeah, you know, there's hidden jokes in there. It's all,
I know.
It's all so beautifully wonderful.
Yes. I think this will be a fun one to revisit when we talk about Tales from the Crypt, but with it being a Tales from the Crypt episode, it sort of just sort of worked out that we ended up doing this one at this time before we got the chance to watch the Tales from the Crypt episodes that preceded it. But I'd love to revisit those, because I know I've seen them before, but yeah. I like to revisit them now, again, in the full context of his career, but also in the context of having really, really, really loved and kind of a newfound appreciation for Death Becomes Her again. So,
Tales from the Crypt is going to be the next one. He's got 3 episodes. Those look really great. I also have not seen any of those. Kyle, you grew up with Tales from the Crypt. I did not, because hyper-Christian household. And we did, and also we didn't. I'm sure I could have watched it if we had HBO, but we didn't when I was younger. But yeah, that's the next one, and then Witches shortly thereafter.
Yeah,
Kyle.
Now it's Bob Z month. Witches month, Richard.
Witches month. Kyle, how do we find you?
I am at Mr. Kyle Bogart on a somewhat dormant Instagram account at the moment, but you know, you never know, Richard. It might come back.
It might. Hey, who knows? Halloween. Spooky time.
There you go.
The show, me, is at Bob Zemeckis, spelled like you would think. Yes, that is the official account.
Stick around. Yes, you are at Bob. You are at Bob Zemeckis, and tell everyone we got to stick around. They got to stick around for the rest of Witches Month. We got nonstop spooks all month. Nonstop spookiness coming at you.
It's a really good push in the month of October to get all of these spooky things out and on the pod. It's been great to build some momentum.
There you go.
Tales from the Crypt next. Later, buttheads.
Later.